following is a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. I'm Andrew Longhurst. In the news this week, we're speaking to Pivot Legal Society lawyer Laura Track about the provincial government's proposed law that would force the homeless into shelters during bad weather. We're also going to be talking to Cineworks Independent Filmmaker Society's program manager Cheyenne Turian about the provincial budget cuts to the arts and what this may mean for Cineworks and Vancouver's art scene at large. We will also hear from Kim Kerr, executive director of the Downtown Eastside Residents Association, on the link between recent hotel evictions and the Olympics, and a special feature exploring the relationship between Aboriginal communities in BC and HIV. We'll have all this plus art, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101. The BC government is drafting legislation that would force homeless people into shelters during extreme weather conditions. The provincial government has stated that it is drafting this legislation to prevent homeless people from dying on the streets. They have cited the death of a woman last winter who died after she lit a candle and burned to death. But many are not convinced that this is the driving force behind this proposed legislation. But many, including the BC Civil Liberties Union, question the timing of this legislation as Vancouver is set to host the Winter Olympics. In a recent interview with the CBC, BC Civil Liberties Union Executive Director David Eby said that, I quote, "It will be a great way to get the homeless, force the homeless off the streets, and then get them out of the view of visitors for the Olympic Games." To discuss the proposed legislation, Laura Track, a lawyer with Pivot Legal Society, is on the line. She has co-authored Pivot's report, Beyond Decriminalization, Sex Work, Human Rights, and a New Framework for Law Reform. Laura?
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what this law would mean for the homeless?
This law would empower the police to basically arrest a homeless individual in cold weather and force them into a shelter. It would have the effect of basically turning shelter operators into jailers. It's really unclear what would happen if once the police dropped the person off at a shelter and they want to leave, how that person would be compelled to stay. But it certainly puts shelter operators in a really difficult position. It appears that the legislation would allow the police to hold an individual if there wasn't an available shelter space for them. There are serious constitutional concerns around that, of course. How can you hold someone and detain them when they have committed no crime other than being poor and homeless? This proposed legislation has a million problems with it. Some are constitutional and legal, but some are just practical in terms of how you compel someone into a shelter space when the reality is that there are not enough shelter spaces available for people who want them. Vancouver does a homeless count every couple of years. We did our last count in 2008, and the results of that count showed that homeless people in Vancouver outnumber available shelter spaces by more than 2-to-1 already. Last year, Vancouver's homeless shelters turned people away more than 40,000 times because the shelters were full. The provincial government has allowed this situation to exist for the last 8 years. Homelessness has exploded in the time that the provincial Liberals have been in charge of this province, and nothing has been done. No attention has been paid to ensuring that our shelters are able to serve the people who need them. Now, all of a sudden, 4 months out from the Olympic Games, this move happens, and all of a sudden, there's this big push to empower the police to bring people into shelters. And as that quote from David Eby suggested, it's pretty suspicious timing. You have to wonder why all of a sudden, after 8 years of neglect, the province cares so much about ensuring that people can be inside during cold weather.
Right. And as you mentioned, there are not enough spaces in shelters to make this possible. Would it mean that if they were then forced off the streets, it would mean that they would be going to a jail cell?
Well, there certainly isn't enough shelter space, and there's not enough affordable housing either to accommodate people. What we know about people who use shelters is that when there are safe, secure shelters available with fewer barriers than exist in many shelters, people will use those shelters voluntarily. So the example of Tracy, I think, is a really informative one. Of course, no one wants to see a repeat of what happened to Tracy or what happened to another homeless man, Daryl McCaskill, the year before, where because the shelters were full, he was sleeping outside and trying to keep warm by using a Coleman stove, which tipped over and caught fire, and he also burned to death last winter. Nobody wants to see that happen, but as with Tracy, she had a shopping cart full of all her worldly possessions, all of her belongings she kept in that shopping cart. And at the time, there were no shelters in the whole of Vancouver that would allow her to store her shopping cart overnight. Mm. And what happens when people leave their shopping carts outside is that the contents are disposed of by the Vancouver police or by city crews. And this happens to people all the time, leaving them without anything at all. When the city of Vancouver opened up the heat shelters in the winter of last year, those shelters were low-barrier shelters. They could accommodate shopping carts. They would allow people with pets to bring those pets in. People could stay with their partners. Many shelters are either male or female, and so people in couples aren't able to stay together. Many shelters won't allow you in if you're showing signs of intoxication. So these are the kind of barriers that exist in many shelters that cause people not to want to use them and to prefer to be outside. I believe that if we created emergency shelters that were low-barrier shelters where people could store their carts, they could bring their pets, where they wouldn't be turned away if they were intoxicated, people would come inside voluntarily. Nobody, in my view, wants to be outside in the middle of winter.
So I'm just going to read a quote from Minister Coleman, the Minister of Housing. He says, and I quote, "There is no movement to say, that we're going to take them to jail, no movement to say we're going to put them in a secure facility." Would this criminalize homelessness? A lot of people worry that it would.
It really seems to, and in light of other initiatives that this province and this city have taken around panhandling, around using private security guards to patrol public space and remove homeless people from the sidewalks in front of businesses and move them along, there are legitimate reasons to fear the criminalization of homelessness and poverty, and we're seeing it happen already. This legislation has set off huge alarm bells for almost everyone who advocates on behalf of homeless people and on behalf of ending homelessness in the province and throughout Canada. And relying on these kinds of punitive measures is the wrong approach. I think what we have to remember is that we wouldn't be in a situation where there are hundreds of people who have no choice but to sleep outside on the streets in the winter if we had invested in the affordable housing that we need to truly end homelessness. Mm-hmm. The city of Vancouver has 14 sites that it's offered to the provincial government to build social housing on, and to date, only a couple of those sites have even broken ground towards building much-needed affordable housing. We really need to abandon initiatives like this proposed legislation and instead invest our resources, invest our energy and our creativity in building affordable housing that will mean we don't have to rely on emergency shelters to keep people safe during the winter.
Why do you think that this law has been proposed, yet there's been no announcement that a lot of the housing projects that are slated to be done are not being completed?
Well, this is a quick fix. This is a way of getting people inside immediately and in time for this winter, and we all know what's coming this winter, the Olympic Games. This is a really easy thing to do that can happen quickly, and it doesn't cost money the way building affordable housing does. But if we really care about ending homelessness and not just cosmetically, not just getting people off the streets for a couple of weeks so that we're not embarrassed during the Olympic Games by all of the tourists and media who are wondering how we can bill ourselves as the best place on earth when we have a homelessness crisis. If we really care about ending this crisis in a sustainable and meaningful way, we need to shift our priorities and get building this affordable housing that we know is the solution to homelessness.
If this law does pass, do you think a court challenge, would it be upheld in court if it was challenged?
I can't see how a law that detains people who've committed no crime, who denies people their civil liberties to occupy public space, I can't see how that type of law would be upheld, and I think it would be challenged and struck down almost immediately.
Are there any other laws in other provinces or other jurisdictions that allow for this to happen?
No, there aren't, and that's really interesting when you consider the climate in other provinces other than British Columbia. We, of course, have the mildest climate in the province, and it's surprising that British Columbia would be the first province that deemed it necessary to pass a law to enable police to bring homeless people inside during cold weather. You would think that if that was really necessary, it would have happened in a place like Alberta or Ontario, where the weather gets much, much colder during the winter months, all of which goes back to why this legislation seems so suspicious at this point in time.
In Victoria, was there not a law passed, bylaw passed, that guaranteed like park space for homeless people?
What happened in Victoria was that a group of incredibly brave homeless people and their lawyers brought a court challenge to city bylaws that prohibited people from sheltering themselves when they had no choice but to be outside. The situation in Victoria was much like it is in Vancouver, where the number of people who were homeless outnumbered shelter spaces significantly, and so people, just by definition and by necessity, were sleeping outside. But city bylaws were preventing themselves from protecting themselves from the elements by erecting a tent or some kind of shelter. And the Supreme Court of British Columbia said those bylaws are unconstitutional. If people have to sleep outside, their lives and their security are in danger if they're unable to shelter themselves and are completely exposed to the elements. And so the court struck down those bylaws as unconstitutional. Hmm. Unfortunately, the provincial government is, the city, with the support of the provincial government, is appealing that decision. Again, investing resources in a costly court appeal and failing to recognize people's fundamental rights to safety and security of the person, and instead challenging that decision in court through an appeal. I expect that the Court of Appeal, well, I am very, very hopeful the Court of Appeal will uphold the decision, and I expect that that decision should be released sometime in the next couple of months.
So regarding the proposed provincial law, what will Pivot Legal Society be doing?
Well, once the draft bill is introduced into the legislature, we'll be reviewing it. We'll take an analysis of its constitutionality. If we have concerns about its constitutionality and about the impact that it will have on people who are homeless, we'll be engaging in a strenuous campaign to ensure the bill is not passed. If it is rammed through the legislature and ultimately passed, we will be willing to assist any person who is detained under that law to challenge their detention and challenge the constitutionality of the legislation.
Well, great. Thank you, Laura, so much for joining us on News 101.
My pleasure. Okay. Thanks very much for having me.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to Laura Track for that interview. The upcoming Olympics are affecting life in the downtown East Side already. And so to continue out out on this topic, we are now bringing you an interview from our friends at CKUT with Downtown Eastside Residents Association Executive Director Kim Kerr about the relationship between the evictions at Golden Crown Hotel and the 2010 Olympic Games.
We are with Kim Kerr, Executive Director of the DIRA, the Downtown Eastside Resident Association. I just want to know, what is, in your point of view, the relation between the eviction of the Golden Crown and the context of the Olympics?
Well, I think it's all about the Olympics. We know that on February 15th, 2007, the owners of the Golden Crown Hotel approached the city permits department about getting permits to renovate the hotel for what they called a use to house either Olympic visitors or Olympic workers. They were straight out about that. They've made those comments in front of reporters before. So here we are, early September 2009, and they're at it again. They're now telling their tenants that they have to be out because of bed bugs. And obviously, they have a legal responsibility and a legal obligation to treat for bed bugs. So we're all over this because we don't want to allow them to do this, obviously. They have 28 rooms, and the rooms they have washrooms in them, which make them incredibly valuable on the Downtown Eastside, and they're sucking every penny out of it. They're charging $750 a month for these rooms. They're infested. The city of Vancouver should have been down there a long time ago to issue orders to these people to make them do the pest control. And I was able to walk through the building yesterday with two city use inspectors, and I'm looking forward to them ordering him to do just that. The concern we have right now is that the city and the powers that be will try and relocate these tenants under the guise that they're helping them, and we'll lose a further 28 rooms. We can't afford to lose 28 rooms, the number of homeless. It's a very valuable piece of property. The owner has been told by a prospective buyer that the property is worth more empty right now than it's worth with people in it, which makes sense because, again, you could redo these rooms, and with bathrooms, they could get a high rate of return from Olympic visitors. It's all about the Olympics.
Beyond the DIRA, what is the possibility of self-organization for the tenants?
Well,
on that kind of context,
the tenants in that place have come together pretty quick. We had about 16 of them in a meeting, and we were pretty straightforward with them. They're not fools, and they understand that this is around the Olympics. Part of the problem that you have is that you get people who are living in desperate situations with no money and getting eaten alive by bed bugs. And so usually what these things happen is that the city neglects to enforce the standard of maintenance by law. It gets some press, which is, it gets through me, and I always have to be very careful of, because then the province comes in and says, oh, we'll provide these people with some housing somewhere else. And then we lose the rooms. And once we lose the rooms, the guy can renovate, as I said, rent them out to Olympic visitors. But his final goal is to be able to make the property available to developers, because right across the street from the Golden Crown Hotel is the Woodward's building, which has been sold to the neighborhood as bullshit around supportive of housing, when in fact it's $500,000 condos. In fact, I'm told you can't even buy a condo in that building for $500,000. They're up to $3 million. So they've got a plan to build condos all the way down the street here, all through the Downtown Eastside, which will displace all of the people who live in the neighborhood currently. In fact, recently, a person who's just moved into Woodward's was on a news program talking about how wonderful it's going to be when they clean up the neighborhood. That's what's coming. Organizing the tenants, it has the challenge that people have so little money and are in such desperate shape and are so thrilled at the prospect of getting even something that has its own kitchen in it, so that no matter what shit BC Housing throws at them, they'll potentially move out of the building. So when I have a city councilor show up at a press conference, she immediately starts talking about relocating the tenants so they can get rid of the bed bugs. That's a no-no. I mean, not that I want to keep people living in a place with bed bugs, but as soon as they open the door to relocating them, they never get back in, and that's the end of the building, and that's the end of housing. It's atrociously expensive. It's unconscionable what he charges, but the hotels are the only thing we have left down here, and the province at this point has bought 25 of them, and they're taking away people's rights in the 25 they bought. They've got agreements called Partners in Action with the police, so the police are able to walk into those hotels. So any kind of housing that you have a key for your door and you don't have the cops and some kind of agreement with a community nonprofit partner, and Darrow was offered two of these buildings and refused to take them because we advocate for people and it would put us in a conflict. It's rough. It's difficult.
Thanks to CKUT for providing us with that story. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver for more news following these public service announcements.
government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education, every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Carrie, darling, Carrie when I cried. If I can't marry Carrie Brown, believe I'd rather die.
You have wandered into the folk oasis. Welcome to it.
Stop the world and let me on.
You are indeed listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I've been trying to keep my mouth shut, baby. I've been trying to change my dark ways, maybe.
Yes, 8 to 10 p.m. every Wednesday night. It's me, Val, hosting 2 hours of eclectic roots music. Folk Oasis.
CITR 101.9 FM presents Sub-City Dwellers, September 29th at Mahoney & Sons Pub, with special guests Great White Shark and The Valuables. Hear Sub-City perform tracks from their latest CD, Where's the Noise? Show starts at 2 p.m., tickets at the door.
Sexual Assault Support Center offers support services to survivors of sexual assault and other forms of violence, as well as their friends, family members, and partners. They are committed to education and the support of students, staff, faculty, and visitors of all genders. They offer counseling, accompaniments, information, and referrals. They also facilitate specialized workshops and training sessions, develop public education campaigns, and hold special events related to anti-violence work. All services are free and confidential. For more information on programs and services or on volunteer opportunities, visit their website, www.ams.ubc.ca/SASC.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
It's 5:30 and the news continues on News 101. The provincial government announced severe and wide-reaching cuts to the arts budget several weeks ago, and the ramifications of this cutback are still reverberating throughout the Lower Mainland. We have Cheyenne Turian, program manager of Cineworks Independent Filmmakers Society, on the line with us now to discuss these cuts.
Hi, Cheyenne.
Hi.
So could you just give us an idea of what Cineworks is and what parts of your budget are at risk because of these cuts?
Sure. So Cineworks is an artist-owned center that focuses on media art, and in particular celluloid-based media art, so actual film. And we have gear and resources for our members to actually make work, and we have a workshop slate of things that we do every year, and we do salons, which are talking-based events, and we do exhibitions. And up to this point, we've had 6 major exhibitions a year, but we haven't actually received confirmation that we won't be getting our funding, but there's no reason to assume that we would be immune. And so it's $45,000 to the organization in this fiscal year that we won't be receiving through gaming, which is approximately 22% of our budget. So immediately what this means is that we have to cancel upcoming exhibitions, and one of the upcoming exhibitions is a yearly celebration of new member works called New Cineworks, so that will not be happening. The remaining two other exhibitions that we have left to produce this year are going to be significantly reduced in scale. Our outreach activities, which are things like where we partner with other organizations to make events happen, like Cineworks partnered with Vancouver New Music, Vivo, the Health Initiative for Men, and a couple other people last year to put on a bunch of programming around World AIDS Day. We aren't going to be able to do that. One of the positions here has had to have their hours reduced to part-time. We're going to have to take on a bunch of fundraising activities. It's possible that if these cuts are not reversed, that in the upcoming fiscal year, we will have to cancel our exhibition program entirely. And that's just, like, off the top of my head, how it's going to be affecting us.
No, yeah, that's quite a list. So while these cuts haven't been officially confirmed, is there anything that you can do to minimize the damage? Are there other sources of funding that you can look to make up the shortfall?
Not in the immediate term. The thing is that this money was supposed to be, we had budgeted for it coming in this fiscal year, so any other grants that we would be applying for would be future-based. So, you know, we'd have to write a grant and wait for a deadline and then submit it, and then there's an adjudication process, and then we'd have to wait and see if we were successful. So there's no sort of government funding that we can go to in the immediate term, although the opportunities to write grants in the longer term. As far as taking action, Kevin Kruger, who is the minister, I can't remember his exact title now, I think that he's the housing minister, I think he was administering the gaming funds, is going to be in town on Monday, actually. So a bunch of us are going to be meeting outside of where he is going to be holding meetings as a visible symbol of our opposition to the cuts, because a lot of his rhetoric has been that he doesn't feel that the citizens of British Columbia are actually bothered by this, and I think that is quite the contrary. So, I mean, if you are able to and you care about it, you should come down, as well as anybody who's listening who cares at all. It's going to be at the WASC Center, which is at Seymour and Hastings.
Yeah, and there's also been some alliances being formed of prominent artists and community members who are strategizing.
Yeah, well, there's the Alliance for Arts and Culture, which acts as an organizing body, and has been really great in providing sort of a central resource place for everybody, because the thing is that these gaming cuts don't just affect art. They affect parent-teacher associations, libraries, sports. It's really far-reaching. So there has been a lot of initiatives in these different communities to try and make contact with each other and, present a united front. But it's also been really difficult because these cuts immediately impact the infrastructure of these organizations. So, you know, CineWorks only has 5 staff members to begin with, and now we have 4.5. And, you know, and we have the regular goings on of our organization. So to have an extra person to be making contact with these disparate communities that have been affected by the grants is difficult, but we're making, you know, the best effort that we can to try and, you know, form these alliances.
So, I mean, obviously this has been put a bit of a dampener on morale in the arts community. Would you say that it's forcing you to forge new connections with other arts organizations, or finding new ways to band together and share?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely like bringing us into face face-to-face contact in a way that we weren't, you know, a month ago. I think that the silver lining to this has to be the fact that we are engaging in so much discussion about, you know, why is art important and what value is there to having, you know, policy money be devoted to art and culture and sport and tourism and libraries. And so, you know, we're having these very sort of broad, deep conversations about the value of these things in our cultural communities, which, you know, is, yeah, the positive part of this, I guess.
Do you see any benefit coming from the Cultural Olympiad, the arts tie-in to the Olympics?
Well, I mean, I think that it's ironic that part of what the BC government leveraged in their bid for the Olympics was the cultural infrastructure of the city, and then these cuts are immediately devastating to that same infrastructure. So it seems very strange to me. I'm not sure that I understand their logic in having, you know, banked so much on these cultural communities and then essentially decimating them.
Great. And so then what's next, looking beyond the Olympics for CineWorks?
I mean, it really depends whether or not we are successful in reversing these funding cuts. If we are not successful, I mean, we're going to have to fundamentally restructure the organization. And it's, I mean, it's difficult to tell what that will actually mean at this point without having to make those decisions. But I mean, just in a broader sense, you know, like the Helen Pitt Gallery is going to have to be, is at the end of October, will be giving up their location after 35 years in this city. You know, it's like, I don't know. So I guess it's just hard to tell what it's actually going to mean, except for the fact that it's going to mean broad, drastic changes. And the inevitable, like, shrinking of the services and that we provide to our community and our members.
For sure. Well, thanks for speaking to us about it this afternoon.
No problem. Anytime.
Thanks.
Okay, take care.
Thanks, Carrie, for bringing us that interview. We now bring you a story from our friends at People First Radio Nanaimo, exploring the relationship between Aboriginal communities and HIV in BC.
This is an MP3 audio clip from the weekly People First radio broadcast.
CHLY 101.7 Nanaimo.
Dr. Perry Kendall, British Columbia's provincial health officer, released his report on the health and well-being of Aboriginal people in British Columbia on June 25, 2009. The report indicated that there is a gap between the Aboriginal populations and other residents, especially in the areas of chronic disease, HIV, AIDS, and mental and behavioral disorders due to psychoactive substance abuse. The report stated that the rate of deaths due to HIV disease for the status Indian population has more than doubled since 1993, while the rate for other residents has decreased significantly in the same time period.
There are approximately 55 to 70 new positive HIV tests among Aboriginal people in British Columbia each year. While Aboriginal people represent approximately 5% of the BC population, they account for 15 to 17% of all new positive HIV tests each year. Aboriginal women make up 30 to 40% of the cases among the total female population, while Aboriginal men make up 10% of the cases among the male population. Studies have shown that drug use among the Aboriginal population may be the reason for the increase in the prevalence of HIV and AIDS.
And we're joined on the phone by Dr. Evan Adams, Aboriginal Health Advisor with the Office of the BC Provincial Officer of Health. Welcome to People First Radio.
Hey, how are you?
We're doing pretty good here. Last month, one of Saskatchewan's medical officers of health warned that HIV could kill from 15 to 30% of Saskatchewan's Aboriginal population over 5 to 10 years. Public health officials later described that as a worst-case scenario, but concern remains high. What's the situation in BC?
Well, when we were compiling our statistics over the last 5 years, we did see that there is, of course, and we all know this, a gap between First Nations health and the other British Columbians' health, that there are disparities. But one of the most shocking areas of disparities was in HIV-related mortality. We did know from previous studies that we were getting HIV much more quickly, and that the population of First Nations people who were getting HIV were different. We knew that there were more women. We knew that there were more people with addictions and psychiatric issues. We already knew that. But what we didn't know was that Aboriginal people already with HIV were dying at a much, much, much faster rate than the general population. The general population's death rate from HIV is actually getting less and less and less every year because of the good care they get. For us, it's the opposite. We actually die faster. And we thought, why? Why this tremendous disparity? And there are lots of theories about why that's occurring, but it's definitely one of the most dramatic things that we found in looking at the many, many health indicators we track at the province.
Dr. Adams, the recent report on the health and well-being of Aboriginal people in BC refers specifically to highly active antiretroviral therapy, or HART, mentioning that currently only approximately 50% of those who are medically eligible for HART receive it. Tell us more about HART and the potential benefits to the Aboriginal population.
Sure. As lots of people know, we've recently, in the last 10 years or so, discovered medications that can counter HIV. And the progression of AIDS. And we know that probably that medication and the access to that medication has improved the quality of life and the longevity of lots of people with HIV, but not so necessarily in Indian country. And so not only are we not accessing HART as often, there are lots of reasons perhaps why that's occurring. So perhaps in general, Aboriginal people aren't accessing care. They're not seeing any doctors as often as they should. They're not receiving perhaps other medications as quickly as they could. And perhaps they live in conditions that further their disease. And this is true for lots of disease entities. We find this with diabetes. We find this with H1N1. If you're not living in a great place, if you don't have running water, if you're poor, then whatever disease you have will be worse, and your outcomes will be worse, and you will suffer more. So that's part of it. We also know that people accessing doctors and clinics and nurses that give out HIV medications is a problem. That there may be clinics that may not feel friendly for Aboriginal people with HIV. Maybe they could be doing more. Maybe they could be doing more outreach. Maybe they could be providing services in a more meaningful way. Perhaps as well, we have to consider that maybe some Aboriginal people with HIV are living in remote and rural areas. They're living in places where they can't physically access good HIV care. There are lots and lots and lots of places where we can intervene and perhaps provide a better quality of care.
Yeah, well, in this, I know that with the current when we had the recent election of Council of Chiefs, that medical care was one of the biggest issues up on the table for all Native people all across Canada, is the difficulty they have accessing medical care, particularly in, you know, away from the urban areas.
Yeah.
So that's a really identifiable source. And yeah, just getting the drug. I mean, Africa is an example of people who can't access those drugs, and look what's happening there.
Yes, exactly. And the physician from Saskatchewan who painted a really worst-case scenario, a couple of important things about that is that she had seen HIV in action in the general population in Africa, and she knew the incredible damage that could be occurring. And we know that there's a lot of suffering and death that's occurring in Aboriginal HIV in BC, but it's not really visible. Nobody's really talking about it. And we know that it's unfair, you know, in a socially just place. You wouldn't see people dying because of their race or their social circumstance. So there's definitely a lot to be done. And I'm really glad that that medical health officer brought the issue to the fore, because we weren't talking about it. We uncovered the statistic, and there should have been a lot more talk about what can we do to change this. This is so unfair that there are hundreds of people with HIV who are receiving inadequate care, suffering and dying really quickly.
Dr. Adams, we have just a moment left. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add to our discussion today.
Well, I think that very often we forget that persons with HIV/AIDS have barriers that come from us as well, that we stigmatize them, that most of us aren't doing enough to help them with their with better quality of life, that most of us aren't doing enough to raise money for them. We aren't doing enough to love and support them and to give them assistance, and that they're worthy and deserving of a lot of work on all of our behalfs. So that's the most important thing, I think, for the general population to know, is that a lot of us stigmatize them, not just them, not just the government or the healthcare workers. Us ourselves need to do more to help them out.
Dr. Evan Adams, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Pathways to Healing, the BC Provincial Health Officer's recent report on the health of Aboriginal peoples in British Columbia, stated that the overall prevalence of chronic disease is increasing and remains higher for the status Indian population compared to other residents. The report stated that the most concerning outlier is the widening gap between status Indians and other residents for HIV/AIDS disease, which is clearly reflective of both increased vulnerability and a lack of access to highly active antiretroviral therapy, or HART. This is People First Radio, and we're holding a roundtable discussion with the issues associated with Aboriginal communities and HIV/AIDS. We're joined on the phone by Fairley Mendoza, a community health nurse with Tsleil-Waututh Health Centre, and in the studio by Tammy Wiley, manager with Tillicum-Laylam Aboriginal Friendship Centre, and Dennis Anno, a community health nurse with Tillicum-Laylam. Welcome. So if you could tell us about the work you're involved in and what you're seeing on the front lines. We'll start maybe with Fairley on the phone.
Yes, good afternoon. I am a community health nurse with Cowichan Tribes in Duncan. We serve a First Nations community of about 6,000 in our area. Have been here about 14 years, having worked on the downtown east side. Prior to coming to the island, I was very conscious of HIV. The community here has its vulnerabilities that are not terribly different than the city. So early in, 2003, there was enough HIV-positive community members who were willing to form a support group. And this has been the kind of center of our prevention and care and support activities for the last 5-6 years. Very, very challenging in a small town. We have not been able to reach out to everybody who's affected by HIV by any means, but it has been a place where we can plan for awareness activities and examine the barriers to treatment that Dr. Evans spoke of.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what are you seeing? What are you involved in?
First of all, my name is Dennis. I work as a community health nurse at Tillicum-Laylam. I joined Tillicum in March of 2006. So prior to that, I've been doing in my capacity as a assistant manager of a long-term care facility. So this is a brand new work for me, which I thoroughly enjoy. We are situated as... Tillicum is situated one block from the reserve, and we cater to people, First Nation, who live on and off reserve. And it's a misunderstanding, too, that we also cater to everybody who go to our door. So, and in my line of work, I do a lot of teaching about HIV prevention, both in group setting and individual sessions. And I do STD screening and HIV testing. Dr. Adams mentioned about earlier about the barriers that are there for the Aboriginals receiving HRRT or HART and treatment and whatnot. Probably Fairley will agree with me saying that in some Aboriginal community, AIDS is seen as a big city disease. She mentioned that, no, there's no difference. Confidentiality and anonymity are difficult in smaller communities as well, so it is mm-hmm. a barrier. Difference also in language or dialects make communication difficult. And where I came originally from the Philippines. Sex and sexual behavior, same with Aboriginal community, those are taboo subjects. we don't call penis or vagina. We call them some different terms. And of course, in some communities, the desire to protect the community may lead to efforts to expel a person living with HIV.
Thanks to People First Radio Nanaimo for that. We're going to take another break now with international news and arts and your weekend weather forecast here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Sending our clients to.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth.
Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
Welcome back to News 101. It's now time to take a look at This Week in Arts with Tracy Fuller.
So this is Paul Zuber with CITR and the Arts Report. I just finished watching the opening of Frozen at the Dorothy Somerset Studio at UBC, and I'm backstage with the director.
Renee Iachi.
And it's Anthony Ingram?
That's it, yep.
Can you tell us, Renee, briefly about Frozen?
It's a play written by Brienne Lavery, who's an English playwright. It's a very controversial piece, I think. It examines forgiveness.
To me, seeing it tonight was also a play about relationships and the relationships between the different characters and what happens when relationships end and how people deal with that. Anthony, your character, it seems to be constantly seeking a relationship. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I guess, you know, my character is a serial killer and child molester, and basically he's never had a relationship with family, so, you know, he talks about his childhood, and his childhood is really fucked up, and I can say it on CATR, can't I?
Yes, you can.
Great. And so, you know, that kind of sets patterns for him into his adult life, and so he seeks relationships mostly with little women, and thinking of them as big women. But then when real women his own age are there, he sees them as mother figures. It's very odd. And so I think that how we sort out relationships and how the relationships that we look for are set up in our childhood is, for my character, it's huge. I don't know that it's huge for the other characters, because their characters are about family, and a one woman who doesn't really have a family, and so she intrudes on another family.
And just to clarify, so that other woman is Agnetha.
Agnetha Gottsman daughter.
Can you say that again?
Agnetha Gottsman daughter.
Okay, I'm glad you said it, because I wouldn't be able to. That's right.
Which literally means from the mouth, the daughter of the mouth of God.
That's a powerful statement. So the relationship. So everyone in the play, to me, is dealing with the relationship of some sort. Ralph is probably the catalyst for the play. Play is definitely focused around Nancy and her acceptance of what happened to her daughter. Why did Shameless Hussy decide to do this production?
Our mandate is telling provocative stories about women to inspire the hand that rocks a cradle to rock the world. And this is a story about, you know, Nancy and what's happened in her life and how she overcomes it. I mean, from the darkest of dark places. If anybody who's a parent imagining their child dead under any circumstance, it's got to be the worst pain that you could ever experience.
Thanks, Paul. And now we take a look at the week's sports with Thunderbird Eye on Sports with Wilson Wong.
very much, and welcome to Thunderbird Eye. Many people are calling Saturday's game a must-win for the UBC football team as they reach the halfway mark of their season. The 1-2 Thunderbirds host the Regina Rams Saturday at 2 p.m. UBC is coming off a loss to Manitoba. Lose again tomorrow, and UBC's road to the playoffs will almost certainly lead to a dead end. Thunderbirds quarterback Billy Green talks about the Regina defense he'll face tomorrow.
They're really athletic. Their linebackers can run. Their DBs are young, but they're very fast. They're athletic, and they play a lot of different coverages. They're unique in what they do on the line, a lot of stunts. They bring guys in different holes, and I think if we can pick it up, I think we have the right things in there to execute.
CITR will broadcast the game live, starting with a pregame show at 1:30 p.m. tomorrow. Our Tyler Noble will call the game along with Ryan Sullivan and Justin McElroy. Fans can listen in on 101.9 FM around the Lower Mainland or on the internet at citr.ca. The women's soccer team is looking for revenge this weekend. After losing 3-1 to Trinity Western last week, UBC gets another crack at the top-ranked defending national champions. This time, the Birds, with a record of 1-1-1, head out to Langley. Kickoff is set for 5 p.m. Saturday at beautiful Spartan Field. The men's team is also heading out onto the road, looking to continue their two-game winning streak. UBC will visit second-ranked Victoria tomorrow afternoon. Then they will play Fraser Valley Sunday at Chilliwack's Exhibition Field. Kickoff for both games is 2:15 p.m. UBC and Victoria are renewing their field hockey rivalry this weekend on campus. The Thunderbirds host the defending national champion Vikes tomorrow and Sunday. Both games start at 1 p.m. Here's UBC coach Hash Kanji on Victoria.
We expect them to always never give up. They hunt for every ball. They work hard for everything. And they never stop till the end of the game. So I think it'll be a good chance for us to play at a level that we know we can play at.
UBC has a perfect record after two games, and both teams are tied atop the history books with 11 national championships each. Now, several more UBC teams are starting regular season play this weekend. The women's rugby team hosts 7th-ranked Alberta on Sunday afternoon. UBC has just 4 regular season games before the conference championships in Edmonton, and the team will then host the CIS Nationals starting November 5th. The rugby men host the Ravens at 2:30 p.m. on Saturday. It's a busy opening weekend for the men's golf team. They're playing at the St. Martin's Invitational in Lacey, Washington this weekend. Then they will travel to Bellingham for the Western Washington Tournament starting Monday. Here's head coach Chris McDonald.
Bellingham was the course that we set the 37-year history of the tournament scoring record there a couple years ago. And, you know, we love the golf course. It's a lot like Shaughnessy. It's tree-lined and maybe a little bit shorter and a little more open. So we usually have a chance to make quite a few birdies there. And I hope we'll have a good result there. I think we can be top three. It's always a really strong field, but we have pretty high expectations for that event this year.
UBC returns only one starter from last year's roster. And finally, we take a look at a couple of teams in exhibition mode right now. The men's volleyball team beat Thompson Rivers in 5 sets last night in Vernon. The same two teams meet again today in Kamloops. And the women's hockey team is in Edmonton for a preseason tournament. UBC faces the host team Alberta Pandas tomorrow at 3:30 p.m. That's your look ahead to UBC sports this weekend. Please tune in tomorrow at 1:30 for UBC football against Regina. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Wilson Wong.
And now, here's your weekend forecast for September 25th to September 28th. After a record-breaking hot day this past Wednesday, temperatures are starting to drop back to seasonal levels. This weekend will be nice and pleasant, as a high-pressure system still dominates in the Pacific Ocean. However, this ridge of high-pressure cell is weakening, resulting in some cloudy conditions this weekend. Friday evening to the overnight will be clear with cloudy periods, low of 11 degrees. Saturday, sunny with cloudy periods, high of 18. Sunday, mostly sunny, high of 18. Monday, it'll be partly cloudy in the morning, but we'll see increasing cloudiness by the afternoon. Next week doesn't look so good. You might as well get out and enjoy the outdoors while the sun still shines. That's your weather forecast, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. Thanks to Alice Wong for preparing that report, and that's our program for September 25th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, and if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Carrie Baptist produced this radio program. Join us Monday at 5 for the next edition of News 101. entire news team at CITR. I'm Andrew Longhurst. Thanks for listening. Coming up next is Hot Mess. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The pinned up of a beige, critical the cake, all up in a ruined GOP motorcades. For these senseless scenes, hurt censor scenes, I earn a soldier's wage. So I broke a leg, Peter rolled the blades, cause I came in that the OG was overpaid. For putting M16s at Brent and D,